Hi, welcome to BCI Cattle Chat. I'm Brad White, joined today by Dr. Bob Larson, Dr. Philip Lancaster, and Debbie Lyons Blythe. Good morning.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning, Brad.
Hey.
It's nice to have Debbie with us. Debbie's a local producer, and she's going to share some thoughts. She's also involved in the U.S. Roundtable for Sustainable Beef, and we're going to talk a little bit about what the U.S. Roundtable has been up to lately, because there's some new information out there that may be useful to you. We're also going to talk about some calving issues and some of the things that we look for on the ranch in the spring, as well as follow up on a listener question related to breeding soundness exams. Finally, we're going to talk about, and we've talked the last couple weeks about all the bull sales that are going on, all the different ways that we can select bulls. And we're going to get Debbie's perspective as both a bull buyer and a bull seller on what are some of the things you want to look for as a when you're going to purchase a bull. Before we get into that, the warm weather has led to people tilling small areas in their backyard and planting things in the garden. Bob, what's the first thing you're going to plant when it gets warm enough?
I like tomatoes. I like homegrown garden tomatoes. In fact, our garden is not big, but it's overrepresented with tomatoes. That's kind of the family favorites. Like, if we're going to go to this much work, let's get something we really like.
Well, sounds like a man after my heart. We like to plant our tomatoes early enough that they die off, and then we get to go through that process again. So we always plant them too early.
Way too early, yeah.
Yeah. Well, what about you, Philip?
Oh, we like to do a pretty big garden now that we live out in the country, but we do all kinds of things. But one of my favorites is radishes. When I was a kid, this was probably a Depression era thing, but my dad always made a radish sandwich. And so I'm doing the same thing.
Were you in trouble
my
or
kids,
something?
No, they're good. They're good.
I'm not sure
I've ever even heard of that. Good night.
Debbie, do you have a garden?
Yeah, I come from a long line of gardeners, and so I cannot measure up to the gardeners in my ancestry, but I do. I actually have a couple of old stock tanks that I've filled with dirt and keep my garden a little tighter that way.
And keep the rabbits away.
Yeah, I don't have rabbits. I have boys with guns, so we don't have many rabbits.
No rabbits.
No, but I have. So like right now I need to be planting spinach and lettuce and beets. We love beets.
It's that time of year, and it's always kind of nice coming through the winter, and we know it's going to come as we get into grass, and that's an exciting time. So we'll talk some about those as we go through. And Debbie, I know you've been on our podcast before, but maybe it would be good if you would give us a brief intro of you, and then we're going to jump in and talk about sustainability in the U.S. Roundtable.
Cool. So I'm a cattle rancher in the Flint Hills. I grew up near Manhattan, and I live at White City now. We have 5 kids and 500 cows, we like to say. Our kids are all grown, though. One of them is back home helping us with the ranch, and that's pretty darn awesome. And the others are fairly close, so we really enjoy that. So we raise both registered Angus and also crossbred. We're a seed stock operation in that I sell private treaty registered Angus bulls and females crossbred bred heifers.
Excellent. And you get a lot of exposure to different herds and different conversations as you're selling both males and females. And we'll talk some about that as we go forward. The other thing, and one of the ways that I got to know Debbie is she's been involved in several different areas. And we've encouraged that before, that not just your local cattlemen's association, but your state cattlemen's association. And then sometimes there are national organizations like the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. Or the one that I've interacted with you most recently, Debbie, is on the U.S. Roundtable for Sustainable Beef. And I think many folks are familiar with that, but it's really a neat organization that brings together producers from cow-calf, auction markets, feed yards, packers, even retailers into the same room to have some of those conversations. And you and I have been a part of, let's say, some interesting conversations because of the differences in perspectives.
Right. Yes, definitely. It's a true round table. That's why they call it a round table, is that we have so many different people involved in trying to decide what's the best approach to beef sustainability. What's the messaging? What does each different sector need? And actually, Blythe Family Farms is a member, a founding member of the U.S. Roundtable for Sustainable Beef.
And that's excellent, because it really has, and the group has really made some progress over the last several years. And I know you were mentioning there's been some output, and we can put a link, but if you go to the usrsb.org, you can find some of the sustainability metrics and assessments. And I know you worked a lot on the sustainability assessment guide. Tell me what that is and how I might use it.
So where we're at now, we've spent the last 5 years, first of all, just getting everybody on the same page from the retailers to processors, packers, feed yards, and cow-calf guys on the same page as far as defining sustainability, first of all. And that's been really, really important. So the quick and easy way to say that is take care of the land, take care of the animals, take care of the people, and make money. So then we wrote basically metrics or ways that we can measure sustainability at each sector level. So we've got what we call our framework, which is, in my opinion, it's a Bible. It's our Bible of the things that we can talk about. It's the foundation of what is sustainability and how we can impact sustainability in the beef industry in America. So now we're to the point where we feel really confident about what we've put together, and it's time to do some outreach. So I am the co-chairman for the outreach committee, and we are right now in the process of creating resource modules for people to learn more about sustainability. We have the cow-calf level right now, a full module, matrix built. And then there's also, we've just released the ones for auction market and feed yard. So what those are is actually the opportunity to go online. They're near, at the same site as the BQA, the Beef Quality Assurance modules, but they're just a series of videos that then ask questions to reinforce information, but they're learning as far as what is sustainability and what does it matter to you on your specific operation and what would you like to focus on? So it's how is it defined and how can you directly impact sustainability on your operation?
Well, I think that's the big one, because we've used that word a lot, sustainability. And I've had many people say, well, what does that mean? And this is a great chance to go through and say, and one of the things we've learned through our discussion, obviously it means different things to different people, but even within the industry, there are different metrics that are important at different levels of the industry. And that's where, and is the sustainability assessment form, is that something I can download, go online, fill out, and it gives me immediate feedback?
Yes, exactly. So go to usrsb.org and scroll all the way down to the bottom, and it's called a self-assessment tool. And it's just a series of about 10 or 12 questions that then you answer based on your operation for each different sector. There's questions for ranchers as well as questions for feed yards, whatever. And then it will actually, based on your answers, give you a red or a yellow or a green for each specific key indicator. So for example, water. If my ranch would be in the yellow for water, I may say yes, but I can't make a change on that. But I know that's important, but that's not something I can change. Let's say though, my ranch is in the red for worker safety. Okay, worker safety is pretty important because that's my kids. And I will tell you, we originally were in the red because you don't do a specific training session each time that the kid is going to get on the tractor. So we did have to incorporate, or at least pay attention to incorporating, some safety information, and especially if you hire people. So if you want to impact your sustainability, this does not certify you. It does not give you any kind of a finished certificate or anything, but it does for yourself, for your own information, say, hey, we can impact sustainability on our ranch.
Absolutely. And I think it's one of the cool things is you don't have to have, if you're envisioning, you're going to have to fill out a really long form or a lot of paperwork that's not going to be necessary for this. You can do an assessment. And then if there are areas where you say, man, I'd like to do better in that area, that's why the resources are there. So then there's modules, there's actually paperwork on there you can look at and say, here's how I get better. Because we know the importance of records in the herd, and it's that time of year when people are calving. And I know you've been calving, Debbie. What's one of the first things you do with your calves when they're born? What's your kind of standard calves born? What are the first steps?
Yeah. So after a bit, of course, we let mama mother up for a little bit. As long as she's doing a good job, we don't want to bother them too quickly. But we do need to get, for our registered calves, we need to get a weight on them. And then we like to, you know, put a little iodine on their navel. But the most important thing that we do is put an ear tag in their ear. And frankly, that is one of the quickest and easiest ways to impact sustainability on your ranch. By tagging your calves and connecting that back to the cow, and being willing to cull the cows that either don't raise a calf or that raise a really cruddy calf, you cull those cows, that is an increase in efficiency and totally an increase in sustainability.
Absolutely. And it doesn't take a very complex, you can have a complex record keeping system, but you don't have to have a really complex one. And I know some folks that do it with their numbering systems on their calves that ties it to the cow, and then we get to the end of the year, I may not have a specific computer program that tracks everything for me, but the cows and the calves are carrying along their records with them. So I think that's valuable, as long as you don't do what I did last year and get the tags mixed up, you're all fine. So yeah, although once I've done that, it allowed my son to say, no, I think that one must be mine, because he's going to pick out thinking there's been tag mix-ups. So, yeah. But as we think about, and she mentioned some of the early health procedures, and we've talked about some of the other stuff, Bob, anything else we should be thinking about health-wise on these calves right after birth?
Well, I think some of the things that Debbie said are really critical. I really do agree that if we can get those calves tagged and match them up with their mother so that I can keep track of their performance. And of course, I'm interested in growth performance and reproductive performance if they're a heifer, but I'm also interested in health performance. So I'm, you know, as a veterinarian, a lot of times I'm investigating problems. And if I can find any pattern to the issues that we're having, such as if we have a scours outbreak later or some summer pneumonia, something like that, by having those calves tagged and really looking for patterns. Is it calves of a certain age that were born during certain time periods? That allows me to really investigate those problems. The other thing that we like to do if possible, so with the commercial herd where we're going to castrate all the males, I like to do that as early as possible. Sometimes that's not the day of birth, but sometimes it can be. And if it isn't at the day of birth, then I like to do it at an early time when we work those calves. So if we get those calves in and vaccinate them at a fairly early age, that's an ideal time to do some of these castration and other health issues.
Yeah, sooner the better on that. And we know that as those calves are growing, they're growing because their mother's giving them milk. And that has a change in her nutritional requirements, right, Philip?
Yeah. So as that cow switches from late gestation to early lactation, her nutrient requirements start to climb through the first couple of months. We generally say that peak lactation happens at around 60 days postpartum. And so that's going to be the highest point of nutrient requirements for that cow throughout the whole production cycle. And so if you compare that time point to what she required just before calving, she's going to eat about 15% more feed than she did prior to calving, but she's going to need 20% more TDN or energy and 40% more protein requirement. So her intake is not going to make up for the difference.
So her intake increases, but not enough. So we need more concentrated feed during that period.
Yeah, we're going to have to increase the concentration of energy and protein in her diet so that she's actually consuming enough energy and protein, even with the increased feed intake.
So I think this is a time to consider if your calf, if they're going through this lactation when we're feeding hay, being selective of what type of hay we're feeding or what type of supplement, if you can calve when they're hitting that nice green grass, as we go through the grass, we get a little later in the spring, that helps make up some of that difference. But I think absolutely, and you guys are correct, and as we go through calving season, we're going to want to have some records of what's happening. So keeping track of those calf tags, when they were born, I think is important. When the cow calved is important when we get later to fall and we get into preg check time, because we'll want to know how did her calf do and how did things turn out. And we want to be sure we meet her energy needs as we go forward. We've had a couple good conversations. The last couple of weeks, we've talked about breeding soundness exams in bulls and selecting bulls, and got a great couple questions. And Bob, I'm going to hit you with these. These came from a listener. And the first one I really like. So I've got two identical bulls. They look identical, same breed, same characteristics. So I'm basically picking based on their breeding soundness exam. One bull was tested at 20 months of age with an above average scrotal circumference. One bull was tested at 10 months of age with an average scrotal circumference. Both passed their BSE. Which bull would you choose and why?
Oh, this sounds like a game show almost.
I know. Yeah, there will be no prizes.
There's prizes.
But right. There will be scoffing if you get the answer wrong.
Yeah, so my answer is really the way I'm listening. So it's a two-year-old bull, right? So he's coming on a two-year-old. Yeah. And one of them hasn't been tested since he was 10 months old. I would be prejudiced against that bull because it's been too long since we've really evaluated his breeding soundness. So I'm not even taking into consideration whether his scrotal circumference was better or worse than the other ones at a certain age. I'm just saying it's been too long. If I had my same dollars and I'm going to go buy one of these bulls, I'd buy the one that has more recently been evaluated by a breeding soundness exam. So that's answer number one. Answer number two is a little bit more tricky, and I have to communicate carefully. Is most breeds in the United States have done a really excellent job of selecting for adequate scrotal circumference in bulls. That was really a problem we identified a few years ago, particularly in certain breeds. And scrotal circumference at a yearling age is tied with age at puberty, both of that bull and his daughters that you might want to keep. And so having better than average scrotal circumference is desirable. But I want to point out, though, that we've been making progress for several decades in this area, so that average is probably good enough, in that if I went into an NBA team and only wanted the above average players for my backstreet game, I would have missed a lot of really good players. Just because they're below average for NBA standards, they'd be great for my team. And so there's a lot of bulls that are, you know, below the 50th percentile, that their scrotal circumference is fine. Not a problem at all. They can perform exactly what I want to perform. So I don't really put my cutoff at average. I put my cutoff at below average. So I'm kind of avoiding those bulls that are in the very bottom few percentile of scrotal circumference. But that means that most bulls in most breeds have an adequate scrotal circumference for what I want. So then I rely on other characteristics, including the rest of the breeding soundness exam. So the semen evaluation, the physical exam, those types of things that I'm really looking at to kind of differentiate these bulls that I'm getting ready to buy.
And if they passed and you have EPDs to go on, and your EPDs, and this is like a lot of our other physical characteristics, our EPDs augment some of our measurements. So I wouldn't look just at one area. And I agree with what you're saying. And relatively, you may want to test that bull again if he hasn't been tested in a while. And speaking of testing time, so follow up to this question, what do you think about not semen testing yearling bulls, but delaying that until they're 14 months old, 16 months old?
Well, I'll answer that easily as a veterinarian, yeah, I like 14-month-old bulls way better than 11-month-old bulls. And anybody that's been involved with testing, you know, if you're a veterinarian testing young bulls or a purebred producer that has, you know, that's selling young bulls, we're doing the testing oftentimes because of how it aligns with, you know, getting bulls sold before the next breeding season. They're right around that 12 months of age, a little bit earlier, a little bit later. And they are just right going through puberty. It'd be like assessing, you know, young boys right before their freshman year of high school and trying to determine how good of a football player they're going to be as a senior.
Because some of them have already been through puberty, some of them haven't.
So much at that time. It's not a perfect prediction. Now, if I can wait until they're a sophomore, I have a whole lot better prediction of how they're going to be as a football player as a senior. It's still not perfect, but it's better. And to me, that's my scenario. That 14-month-old bull, he's more like a sophomore. He's almost all of them have already gone through puberty, and I can really assess them. When I'm doing it really young, I may miss some excellent, excellent fertility bulls that are just, you know, weeks, not months, but just weeks behind their peers. And so I like to delay it if possible. Now, the problem is you go to a bull producer like Debbie and you start looking at the calendar and you say, well, I want my bull sale to be the first week of March. And where these bulls were born in, you know, February, March, and April. So they're not going to be 14 months of age at the time I want to sell them. And that's just the hand that we're dealt. And so I will test younger bulls, but what I say is I don't necessarily fail them. I fail to pass them, meaning that I'm not going to be prejudiced against a high school boy that doesn't look like a linebacker as a freshman. I'm going to wait until he's a little bit older to say, yeah, you can play varsity linebacker or not. And so he stays on the team. We just evaluate him a little bit later to see what position he belongs in.
Debbie, does that align with what you see on your operation?
Yeah, I like his analogy a lot about the football player because those bulls are athletes. That's so important that we treat them as athletes and feed them as athletes. I might just make a point. I don't think I'm disagreeing with you, but I think I might just make one point that if a bull reaches fertility, goes through his puberty a little bit earlier, then I think that's a positive. I think that that maybe also would indicate that his heifers might reach puberty a little bit earlier, his daughters. And so I do sell both yearlings and two-year-olds. And for my situation, we're teching them right at a year of age or just a tick before. And I feel like those bulls that are passing at that age, I feel really good and strong about those.
Yeah, no, I do agree with you. The problem is a lot of times, you know, the purebred producer, we do bull testing on one day. And so I've got bulls that range from 11 to 13 months of age. And I just don't want to be overly hard on the 11 and 12 month old because it's just some of that is just age. So among bulls, I want them all to reach puberty by 12, 13 months of age. And they really, most of them should. But on breeding soundness day, I've got a fairly good range of ages and I want to kind of treat that appropriately.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I agree. I think them to reach puberty early.
I think what you're saying is if they have reached puberty at that stage, all good. If they haven't reached puberty at that stage, they still can be a good fertile bull and they may fit into somebody's operation. And what Debbie's saying, which I would agree with, is there are times that early puberty may be important, maybe to your operation, maybe not. And we'll talk about that here in a minute on how we figure out which of those is most important. Last one, and I want to address this a little bit because I think this is a good question. We talked about scrotal circumference measurements, and we talked about the importance of that, and we just emphasized that as we talked through that once they pass, there could still be some differences. But different people measure, and Bob, if you and I went out and measured scrotal circumferences, how close do you think we'd be? How repeatable is this among people?
Between people, it can be a little bit different. You know, up to a centimeter or two difference is not unusual between veterinarians. And so one of the questions is, do we need a more standardized tool? And so there have been some people that have come up with kind of standardized tape measures that put more of a consistent amount of pressure on. And I like those. I think they're fine. I think a lot of it has to do with, I think I'm pretty consistent myself, and I think you're pretty consistent yourself. And if a producer and a veterinarian, that, you know, the same veterinarian is evaluating a herd over time, as long as that veterinarian is consistent, I think you're getting good information. But, you know, we've got a lot of multi-veterinarian practices where, you know, Debbie might get one veterinarian one time and a different veterinarian the other time. And then something that's a little more standardized may be helpful. So I would just put it back to, well, it depends on the situation. I haven't broken down and bought one of the nice new expensive consistent ones because I'm only assessing myself. I'm not going across veterinarians, but if I was in a multi-person practice, I might be interested in that.
The thing that makes me feel better though is so it's not a perfect system, right?
It's perfect.
You and I going out and measuring, but it's a piece of the puzzle.
Yeah.
If you say, boy, this doesn't align with how the bull looks or any other quality of the bull, then well, maybe we should remeasure it. Or if it aligns with everything else you're seeing, we're not making decisions solely based on scrotal circumference.
Right.
But I think you have to remember, and this for Philip maybe too, how the bull is fed and how much fat is on that bull is going to make a tremendous difference. And remember, it's the differences within the herd that actually go into the measurement. So I have a benchmark. I won't keep anything below a certain measurement, but it's actually the ones that are really, really above that measurement and the ones that are really, really below. That's how I determine. But Philip, doesn't nutrition matter too?
Well, yeah. If you feed that bull too hard early on, he's going to start deposit fat in the scrotum and that would affect the scrotal circumference measurement that you get. And ultimately it affects the testicular development and breeding soundness of that bull.
Yep, absolutely. So I think there's some value and most times we are consistent in going through those, at least within person. You go between people, it wouldn't surprise me if there's some changes. Last thing I wanted to visit about, and Debbie, I think this will be of interest to our listeners, is we've talked some about picking bulls from our perspective, right? From the health perspective or from the nutrition or from the economic. When we think about it from a strategic level, if I'm a new customer and I come to you and I say, hey, I'm interested in, we'll say I'm interested in your bulls. How do I pick the right bull for my operation out of the ones you have available? What are some of the things you'd tell me or ask me?
Yeah, so I sell private treaty only. I don't have a sale and I've been involved in a sale before, but I still think that these things are valid. These questions and this conversation is valid even if you go to a sale. So you should call and discuss things before the sale. Don't just go sale day. But for a person coming to my ranch that wants to look at bulls, my first question is, what do you do with your calves? So, and how do your cows look? What traits do you need? Do you sell at weaning time? Do you maintain ownership? Do you keep heifers back? What kind of cows are you breeding? Do you have any heifers or are they all good, solid, big cows? What do your cows weigh? So my specific conversation before we even go out and look at the bulls is just wondering, you know, what kind of cow herd they've got and what are they doing with their calves? And then we'll go out and look at the bulls as a group and kind of start highlighting based on their information, their EPDs, highlighting ones that I think would fit for their program. And then we'll pull off, you know, 5 to 10 bulls specifically so that they can evaluate them in a separate pen aside from the whole group. One of the things is too, is just helping them understand EPDs. Sometimes we get new EPDs all the time and different breed EPDs are, you know, differences. And so I just kind of explain to them what the new EPDs are and which ones I feel are the most important for what kind of cow herd and what they do with their calves.
Well, and I think that's the key is it goes to your herd, right? So Bob might come and I might come and you might send us to two different bulls because of our goals or what our plans are. But I also think a lot of folks, some folks buy bulls, multiple bulls every year. Some folks buy a bull a year. Some folks buy a bull every couple years, depending on what your herd size is and what your requirements are. And I think finding a partner that you can have those discussions with, that you can say, hey, here's one of the things I'm thinking about. Here's what I'm looking at. What makes sense for my operation is really important. And I know, Bob and Philip, you guys have both kind of been through that process from both sides of the spectrum. Do you have any input there as far as things to think about?
I like what Debbie said. And I think I mentioned this last week when we were kind of talking about this same topic, is knowing what you need to change. You know, we're talking about paying for a bull, and you know, if you're selling calves at weaning, the classic example is, you know, you're not going to get paid very much for a high marbling calves. And so paying for that top marbling EPD bull in the sale is not money well spent. And so I really like that she focused on that, and determining what you need is the most critical step.
Yeah. And since we've got the sports analogy going, I'm going to continue it and say, you know, so a really good football team or a really good track team has a bunch of good athletes, but they don't do the same thing. As we're approaching track season, we've got shot putters, we've got sprinters, we've got long distance runners. Each of them are excellent athletes in their field, but you can't have the fastest sprinter who is also your best shot putter. I mean, there are traits that are just going to be antagonistic. And so if I need a little more speed, then I go for I preferentially get some extra sprinters on my team. If I need a little bit more strength, I preferentially get a few. I don't ignore everything else, but I align what I need to get the best balanced team. Because as a team, I want kind of that decathlete that's really good at a lot of things, but I get there by picking the bulls that just complement what I need, and what I do well, and what I need some help with.
I don't know, Bob. I got distracted while you were talking, Bob, just thinking about this new sport of somebody running 100 yards, carrying a shot put, throw it.
Oh,
yes,
I like
that
it.
That would be, yes, then you could get it. Then you could really get it going. So I think there's a lot to think about as you go through that process. And Debbie, I've really appreciated you joining us today and talk a little bit about sustainability. We'll put a link in the show notes for some of the resources that Debbie mentioned at USRSB and the Sustainable Beef Roundtable. We also want to thank you for listening. And if you have questions, anything you'd like us to talk about or topics, you can always send us an email at bci@ksu.edu.